Susanna non vien. Sono ansiosa di sapere come il conte accolse la proposta. Alquanto ardito il progetto mi va. Ed uno sposo si vivace e gioso.
J to welcome you to part two of our discussion on critical thinking with Anthony Freud of Lyric Opera of Chicago, general director thereof. I, Andrew Patner, your host and producer of this series, welcome you to this edition with music and a performance selected by Anthony Freud. I bet, well, of course you know what it was. It was Dove Sono. It was the Countess from Nozze di Figaro of Mozart. And I bet you all knew that that was a hardworking person in show business, because in addition to an international career as an operatic and concert soprano and crossover artist, she's also the creative consultant.
She is, Renee Fleming. And wasn't that a gorgeous performance? It was a perfect blend of vocal beauty and dramatic perceptiveness. It was wonderful how the moods of the Countess were so perfectly demonstrated and conveyed by Renee in that recording.
And this is Renee at, I would say, an early height when she's working with Schulte. Right.
Yes. It was recorded in 1996, which is 2 years after I think I first heard Renee, which was singing the Countess, that role, at Glyndebourne, when the new Glyndebourne Opera House opened, which I believe was the summer of 1994. Mm. I was just working at Phillips Classics, coming to the end of my time there, on my way, in effect, to becoming general director of Welsh National Opera, which I began in the fall of 1994.
Why don't we walk quickly through your career in terms of dates and places that will also, I think, illuminate some of our discussion, both of Renee Fleming and of some of the other music that you've brought in, because people may see some sequencing here and some threads that run through your interests and tastes.
I'm a lawyer. If you go back far enough, I'm a barrister. I studied law at King's College London, and I chose King's College, which is in the Aldwych in central London, because it was halfway between the National Theatre and the Royal Opera House. And I spent more time in those two institutions than I did in the law library, I have to confess, because I had long since developed my passion for the arts, for opera, for theatre, for music, for dance. I was very excited to study law, but I was particularly excited to be in central London for several years, able to indulge that passion.
And to your credit, because discipline is a part of administration as well as passion, you did carry through. You did complete
your studies. Oh, yes. I graduated with honors. Then pursued my professional training, and I was called to the bar, as it's called in the UK, if you're a barrister, in 1979. And I got on well. I enjoyed myself at the law. I did my pupillage. I did marshalling with a high court judge on circuit, which was a very interesting experience when you're accompanying a high court judge and learning what it's like from the judicial perspective rather than from the lawyer's perspective.
What we call clerking for a judge, which is different because you clerk earlier and in a different way in Britain if you're preparing for the bar or studying. And I didn't know that part. I didn't know that you did that work on top of after your
completing. I did. And I was already conscious of the fact that although I was enjoying the law, I was surrounded by people who had a really strong sense of vocation for it. And my sense of vocation was for the arts. I was offered what's called a place in chambers, which is an important hurdle to jump when you're qualifying as a young barrister. And I went to see my prospective head of chambers and said, well, I'm really flattered and grateful that you're offering me a place. Would you mind if I took a few months off? Because I'd love to spend a few months working in the arts. And I'm not sure any newly qualified barrister had ever made that request of him. And he said, well, okay. So I then wrote 60 or 70 letters to people I didn't know saying, I'm a newly qualified barrister. I have a passion for the arts. Might you have a job for me? And out of those multiple letters came one job at Sadler's Wells Theatre in London. And I started there in 1980.
And this was a focus on dance at the theatre, on theatre, on the full array of arts at that point?
It was a focus on everything the theatre did, which was more dance and ballet than anything else, but also opera and a certain amount of folk dance. It was a great experience. I was the assistant to the director. The director was Stephen Remington at the time. I learned an enormous amount from him. I, after about 18 months, became theatre manager. I was company manager of New Sadler's Wells Opera, which was a newly created, sadly short-lived operetta company that, was formed at Sadler's Wells. And I, throughout this time, thought that probably opera was my destined home, and I moved from Sadler's Wells to Welsh National Opera in 1984, and that was the first time I'd ever worked for an opera company. Brian McMaster, later Sir Brian McMaster, who became a very successful director of the Edinburgh International Festival, was the general director of Welsh National Opera, and I learned a huge amount for him. It was a whole university master's degree in how to understand the practical aspects of producing opera.
All of those interested in careers in the arts, in serious and fun careers in the arts, heed these words from Antony Freud. I recently did a phone interview. I haven't yet met him, but with Jeff Alexander, who's the will be the incoming president of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra Association. And in the same way, what did he want to talk about? How he learned the nuts and bolts over the years with different types of organizations, different types of people, and different types of companies. And if you build on that foundation, when you then get to an opera company in a new place or a new country, you bring with you experience and you bring with you an understanding of the language of the workplace, as well as a love of putting people up on stage.
I left Welsh National Opera in 1992 and became executive producer for Philips Classics. It was a very exciting opportunity to live in a new country. I lived in the Netherlands and to learn a new business, the business of creating classical music recordings.
What were you doing for those 8 years, that first round at Welsh National?
Initially, I was company secretary, so I was legally responsible for the company, but in effect worked very closely with Brian McMaster, who was generous enough to give me an opportunity to shadow him, in effect, in virtually everything he did, from union negotiations to casting committees. I then became director of opera planning, which is more commonly called in the United States artistic administrator, in which I was responsible for contracting the singers, negotiating contracts, scheduling seasons, scheduling performances, tours, rehearsals. It's a fantastic job because actually it's one of the only jobs in an opera company in which 100% of your time is spent engaged with the art form.
Right. Right. And then to the record industry, when the record industry still was, there were already some signs of concern, but the record industry still was something, and Philips was very something.
It was an exciting place to be. Part of my responsibility was to work closely with a number of exclusive Philips artists. And so I had the great privilege of working closely with people like Bernard Haitink, Jesse Norman, John Elliott Gardner, Seiji Ozawa, Colin Davis, and Neville Mariner, et cetera, et cetera. It was a thrilling immersion into a different world. But it was a world that, while I enjoyed it enormously, I don't think I ever got over missing the intense excitement of a live performance. Mm-hmm. And I returned to my crazy world of producing opera when I became general director of Welsh National Opera in 1994.
What had your familiarity with Wales been before you took that position?
Limited, I must say, to the coincidence of my being marshal to the High Court judge, Mr. Mm-hmm. Justice Kenneth Jones, mm-hmm. on circuit in Wales. I spent about 6 weeks in a wonderful house outside Swansea in West Wales. And, of
course, if his name was Jones, you know he was Welsh.
Indeed.
So.
And I think you can probably understand a little bit about me when I say that already at that time, I had a missionary zeal for opera. Mm-hmm. I, of course, was aware that Welsh National Opera was on tour in Swansea while I was there. And I persuaded the judge to come to the opera with me a couple of times.
Wow.
Little did I know that when I took the judge to those Welsh National Opera performances, I would very soon after be working for the company.
Yeah. I just love that. And it also reminds us when we see these pictures, whatever your politics might be, of Justice Ginsburg or Justice Scalia going to or from the opera in Washington or New York here in the United States, maybe a clerk once introduced them or maybe they've introduced their clerks.
And that's a happy coincidence because I had the huge honor of being on a panel with Justice Ginsburg and,
right.
and getting to meet her and spend a little time with her.
At the American Bar Association, I think.
Indeed.
Yes,
indeed.
Right.
Which
Wonderful.
Was a great, great thrill.
Wonderful. So you learned some of the artist handling, or you added to what you knew. You learned some of the commercial side of the business. You learned some of the distinctions between live and recording, spiritually, philosophically, as well as practically. And then you went back to Cardiff, but this time as the number one, as general director.
As general director. I started at Welsh National Opera in September 1994, uh-huh. so it's the 20th anniversary of my start as a general director of opera company.
Right. And while in Cardiff, you said you encountered René Fleming.
It was actually right before I became general director of Welsh National Opera. I was working very closely with Bernard Haitink. Haitink was then music director of Glyndebourne, and so I went to his performance of The Marriage of Figaro at Glyndebourne, which was the production that marked the opening of the new Glyndebourne Opera House, and René was singing The Countess.
Mm-hmm. Can we see then from that experience and her experiences with you then in the UK why Houston has a connection in her history, or is that coincident?
It's complete coincidence
okay.
because I met René very briefly. I've never reminded her of this, and she has no reason to remember. But I met her very briefly when I was at Philips a year or so earlier in Antwerp. She was just getting started and was already making a very, very strong impression, certainly on me, but also on the operatic world as a whole.
Right.
But no, the coincidence of my now having the great delight to work closely with René really has nothing to do with the fact that I first heard her in 1994.
Well, but it has to do with it in the sense that we can still see the legitimately star-struck stage door Johnny that you described last week that you were as a kid, because it's clear you were a discerning stage-struck kid as you remain as an adult.
I continued to be stage-struck, and I hope I will always be stage-struck.
Yeah.
I think a sense of fascination for theater and for music and for opera, a sense of thrill every time I walk through the door of the Civic Opera House, a sense of anticipation before every performance I attend, let alone those for which I'm responsible, is something that I think is a fundamentally important part of being able to be a general director successfully.
I think you arrived here after he had died. Maybe you met him in other contexts, but the host of our longtime weekly opera recordings program, Andy Karzis, for many years began the program from the recording horn by saying that the program featured recordings by singers who were once among the great celebrities of their time. And that sense of the importance and the occasion of a great singer or a great pianist or a great conductor, it's not necessarily any kind of pomposity or worshipfulness. It's something that has to do with a person who has a gift to bring passion and excitement. You've been
one. And Renee encapsulates everything you're saying, because I think she is one of the great figures of our time. It shows that possibility is not extinct.
Right. And fortunately, the Super Bowl people recognized that last year as well. And we can talk about fear of classical music at another time. Actually, In terms of the positive side of all of this, of the excitement, one of the things that you have wanted to do throughout your career, and you mentioned that even before your career with your parents and then with the judge, is to introduce other people and to have them share the excitement. And one of the things you did in Houston, and now you get to Houston in what year?
In 2006.
Okay. And in your time in Houston and carried over now into your time here in Chicago, you look around and you say, well, who lives in Houston? And what do they do? And what's their music like? And what might bring them to the Opera House? And that winds up with a Jewish guy from London working to help create the first mariachi opera.
That's right. I'd been in Houston for only a few months, and I noticed that in the opera house promoted by somebody else was going to be a concert by Mariachi Vargas. I grew up in Wimbledon. I knew nothing about mariachi, and I thought, well, this is in our opera house, don't know anything about it, I better go and see what it's like. So I bought myself a ticket and was blown away. Blown away by the fact that the opera house was full of people, our opera house, that I had no recognition of at all. And secondly, by the fact that this concert was given by a group of 13 extraordinary virtuoso musicians and singers. And literally sitting in the concert, I thought, well, this is immediate, this is emotional, this is accessible, this is so operatic. Why has there never been a link between mariachi and opera before? And sometimes you have ideas and 10 minutes later you realize they're dumb and you move on. Well, this time I thought, well, let me explore that. And I did some research, and indeed there seemed never to have been a mariachi opera before. I was passionate about ensuring that Houston Grand Opera related to as many communities around the city of Houston as possible. And of course, the Mexican community is very important in Houston, as it is in Chicago. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be wonderful to mark the 2010 dual anniversaries of Mexico, the centenary of the revolution, the bicentenary of independence, by commissioning the world's first mariachi opera? So I did.
Oh my! I've never seen so many butterflies here.
They stopped to let me know they haven't forgotten me. They're on their way to Mexico. It's that time.
I've always wanted to go there and see them.
You will. We'll go together.
La historia de un niño que miraba hacia el cielo, mirando la llegada de monarcas en vuelo. Millones volaban ya y el cielo se coloreó, pasando por la llanura, cruzándose por la luna. ¿Dónde vinieron, niño, las mariposas en vuelo? ¿De dónde vinieron, niño, que hasta alumbraron el cielo? Noche tras noche estaba sentado en su ventana para mirar al cielo y así ver su llegada. ¿De dónde vinieron ya? El niño quería saber. Millones de mariposas él las quería acompañar. ¿De dónde vinieron, niño, las mariposas en vuelo? ¿De dónde vinieron, niño, que hasta alumbraron el cielo?
Grandpa, are you sorry you came here?
How could I be sorry? Then there would have never been your father, or you.
But have you ever been happy here, all these years?
So many questions. Ever since you were a little girl, I should have known you would grow up to be a writer.
I'm sorry.
Don't. Don't be sorry.
Es la historia de un niño que fue muy tonto. Nada sabía del mundo, solo de mariposas. Corrió desde las montañas pensando poder volar, mas solo las mariposas cruzan la cara de la luna. ¿De dónde vinieron, niño, las mariposas en vuelo? ¿De dónde vinieron, alumbraron el cielo?
The title song from Cruzar la Cara de la Luna, To Cross the Face of the Moon, Houston Grand Opera, the first mariachi opera, and Anthony Freud, the commissioner of this opera. Tell us more about this song and about the people we heard.
It was sung by Octavio Moreno, an excellent young Mexican baritone, and the players were Mariachi Vargas, the great world-renowned mariachi, and the recording was actually of the world premiere performance of Cruzar la Cara de la Luna. The song is sung by a character called Laurentino, an old man who is reminiscing to his granddaughter that as a child he saw millions of butterflies, mm-hmm. monarch butterflies, flying across the sky, and he dreamed of joining them wherever they were going, but ultimately realized that only butterflies can cross the face of the moon.
Yeah. It was a beautiful moment in the production when it was done in Chicago as well, with many of the same contributors involved,
the same cast. The same cast and the same mariachi.
And this had a tremendous response in the community.
It did. The story is very universal. It's an old man who was born in Mexico, who moved to the United States under the Bracero Migrant Worker Program in the 60s. We meet his adult son and his teenage granddaughter, both of whom were born in the U.S. And as the old man is dying, they find out from him for the first time that he also had a family in Mexico whom he left behind. And he wanted to see the family again before he died.
And this was the government program that brought working men into the United States who otherwise would not have been able to immigrate here legally and who ostensibly were to work, make money, and then leave.
Except that Laurentino didn't leave.
Right.
And
as I say, ostensibly.
The piece is about what is home. Is home where you're born,
is
home where you live, is home where you die. So it's an extraordinarily universal story.
Absolutely.
And one of the things that excited me most was that audiences of all backgrounds, not just people from the Mexican and Latino communities, from an enormous range of backgrounds, were thrilled by the piece, were cheering and crying with equal measure. And many people came up to me at the end and said, "You've just told my story." Mm-hmm. And that I find profoundly important, because what is it that we should be doing as one of the world's great opera companies at Lyric? We need to be providing people with extraordinary, transformational, life-enhancing experiences. We need to entertain, but we also need to be revelatory. And in telling stories that resonate with people so powerfully that they feel that they can learn important life lessons from their experiences at Lyric is something that I think is one of the key purposes of our existence and of the existence of great opera companies around the world.
Hear, hear. We'll be talking in more detail as we get closer to it in 2015, but there's going to be the second mariachi opera, correct?
Called El Pasado Nunca Se Termina, The past is never finished. Created by the same team, Pepe Martinez, composer, and Leonard Folia, librettist and also director of the production.
And in between these two, there was what I thought was another revelatory evening, and that was another kind of experiment where you took Mexican son and other kinds of song and Italian opera, and you presented them with a mixed cast of non-Italian, non-Mexican, Mexican, etc., Puerto Rican.
It was a mashup.
It
was called Canciones y Arias, and it was an evening of mariachi and opera that included, for me, absolutely magically, some mariachi-accompanied opera.
And I sat by chance behind you and Colin, your partner, we'll talk about in a bit. And we were all just knocked out, I think, more by that than anything else, even though all of it, this was at Benito Juarez High School on the near southwest side.
Yes, in Pilsen.
Packed, turning people away. When people say people aren't interested in music or they're not interested in culture, they're not interested in opera, they should have been in that lobby. And your hunch was right. These musics play off of each other and enhance each other.
Yes. And once you hear Questa Quella, the Duke's first act aria from Verdi's Rigoletto, accompanied by mariachi, you sort of never want to hear it any other way again.
Absolutely. Speaking of music that you probably don't want to hear any other way again after you hear this singer sing anything.
Anyone can whistle, that's what they say, easy. Anyone can whistle any old day, easy. It's all so simple, relax.
Live at Carnegie Hall in February of 2001, the great Barbara Cook, still kicking, still singing beautifully into many, many decades, accompanied by one of the great unheralded geniuses of music theater, cabaret, and song performance, the late Wally Harper, who also made those arrangements of the Sondheim Evening, and John Beale on bass. That's from Barbara Cook's Mostly Sondheim Live at Carnegie Hall, and that, of course, is the title song of Anyone Can Whistle. Why this one, Anthony?
I love musicals. I love Sondheim. I'm an absolute Sondheim groupie. And I love Barbara Cook. She brought that program, that concert program, to London. And mm-hmm. it played in the West End for 3 or 4 weeks. I went once and was totally mesmerized by it. So I got myself tickets for the next 3 consecutive days. Anyone Can Whistle was the encore in that program.
Right.
And to me, it is an example of great singing, as great as any singing that I know. I don't think any performance by any singer of any age, of any leader, will convey with any greater depth the subtlety, the point, the emotion of that extraordinary song. The message of the song I find so touching, and I respond to it. It resonates with me very strongly. What's hard is simple. What's natural comes hard. Maybe you could show me how to let go, lower my guard, learn to be free. I have in my job to do a lot of public speaking, a lot of entertaining, a lot of socializing. I'm actually an introvert, and I find it quite challenging at times to be as up and as communicative as I often have to be. Mm-hmm. And so I find that song hits the nail on the head in a way that so often happens with Sondheim.
Mm-hmm. I think also, in addition to those very insightful comments and reasons, there's the idea that it's whistling that anyone can do, that everyone has some sort of art or music in him or in her, in addition to having an ability to grow and interact. Part of that comes from letting go from the purely practical and letting oneself run a bit. And that's also part of the story of the musical itself, Anyone Can Whistle of Sondheim. If you ever have had or still can have the privilege of seeing Miss Cook, she's the same if she's performing in a 40-seat cabaret in the Carlisle Hotel. She's in an arena or a West End or a Broadway theater, and she'll put the mic down for at least one number and just sing, and you hear it all the way back. A reason, again, to learn those nuts and bolts early on. Not many people can carry that technique over 6-7 decades.
And Anyone Can Whistle was that number in that program. She sang it with no amplification.
Right. We come now to Chicago in a number of ways, because you are united in Chicago with another United Kingdomer, Andrew Davis, when he arrived, and then he became Andrew Davis CBE, and we should say that Anthony Freud is OBE, the Order of the British Empire. Where's that empire?
But I know, someone's mislaid it. It's a real problem.
And then, of course, from CBE, Andrew Davis became Sir Andrew Davis.
And working with him is one of the great delights of my job, I have to say. He's a great conductor, a great human being, a great music director. I'm so lucky to be able to spend so much of my working life with Andrew, planning, chatting, dreaming, making things happen together.
And for those of you who only know Andrew Davis from seeing him in the pit or taking a bow at the end of a performance, you already know one of the key things about him, which is with Anthony Freud, he shares the big E enthusiasm, and he communicates it very directly.
He does, not only in performance, but also in rehearsal.
And I was going to say, for those then who don't see that part, that's how he communicates in rehearsal. That's how he communicates at lunch. It's not forced. It's not artificial. And it's not overdone.
Yesterday, we had the Sitzprobe, which means sitting rehearsal. It's the first time the singers and the orchestra work together in the process of rehearsing and producing an opera for Don Giovanni, which is the new production that opens Lyric's new season in a couple of weeks' time. And Andrew conducted that score with such wisdom, with such brilliance, but also such integrity. It's so rare in my experience to find a great conductor who also somehow retains his humanity in everything he does.
And humility.
And humility.
Which I mean is a compliment.
and what's fascinating, and forgive me, Andrew, if I lead us into the next piece of music, because there is no piece of music less humble than Elgar's Pomp and Circumstance March No. 1. It was written in 1901 when the world was teetering on the edge of the abyss, but it's a piece of music that really gives no sign of any awareness that the old world is coming to an end and will disappear forever. And somehow Andrew's performance of this is extraordinarily witty as well as being thrilling. Of course, he captures the grandeur and the pomposity of the music with great brilliance. But one of the reasons I love this performance so much is that it somehow transcends its seriousness in a way that builds to the most exhilarating of climaxes.
Recorded in 2011, the BBC Philharmonic with Sir Andrew Davis. And this being a good British production, the work is called by its real name, Military Marches, Pomp and Circumstance, Opus 39, March No. 1 in D major. And you even heard the full organ. Fitting too that we are recording this just a few days after you might have heard the last night of the Proms, and then you get to add the words Land of Hope and Glory to a part of that. But just as Antony Freud of Lyric Opera of Chicago, and now of Chicago, has explained, Sir Andrew has such a connection. Should you ever come across an internal document of Lyric Opera of Chicago, and I, of course, as a critic and journalist, have never seen such a thing, you will see references regularly to SAD, sad, and you think of dark winter and people who are deprived of light and have depression. No, it's Sir Andrew Davis. Sad says ... That's the only thing sad about him. And we're very fortunate to have him as the music director here. And we're very fortunate it's not always the case that when a music director arrives somewhere that he and the general director get together, or when a general director comes somewhere that she and the music director hit it off and get together. But you all have had a great working relationship.
We have a great time.
You're also, as it's clear throughout this and where you fit this in with your study of the world of the performing arts and your formal study of the law, you're a great student of history. I mean, and by that I don't just mean you recite names and dates. I mean you feel these things. Some of that maybe because of your family, some of that because of your own curiosity. We talked about how the Pomp and Circumstance marches were written at a time when the world's on the edge of the abyss, and that E is going to disappear eventually from the OB and the CB after British. And here's another work that takes a very different kind of view, written in that same fin de siècle, the last siècle period.
Interestingly, written about 5 years before the Elgar, Mahler's Symphony No. 2. If you held a gun to my head and asked me, told me, actually, with a gun to my head, to name my favorite composer, I think it would be Mahler. I don't really know why. I don't know if it has anything to do with my Central European roots and the fact that his very peculiar blend of tragedy and comedy strikes a chord with me. I love his sense of nostalgia. I love his sense of wistfulness. I love his sense of sadness. I suppose I don't think I'm at all a sad person, and I know I'm absolutely optimistic, but I respond to artistic darkness. We heard last week a performance of Der Leiermann, the last song of Schubert's Winterreise. You can't get more desolate than that, and it reads very clearly to me. This is Urlicht. This is the first of the vocal movements from Mahler's Second Symphony. Mankind lies in greatest need, says the text. Mankind lies in greatest pain. I would rather be in heaven where a light will lead me to blissful everlasting life. It's a wonderfully sad and yet uplifting few minutes of some of the most eloquent music ever written.
Thank you.
Janet Baker, certainly by then Dame Janet Baker. Hard to think that 1986 is almost 30 years ago. It seems like yesterday. The very young conductor then, Simon Rattle, was leading his orchestra, the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, the Irrlicht, from the Resurrection Symphony, Symphony No. 2 of Mahler. Again, I think this tells us a lot about Antony Freud, not just that he loves Janet Baker, because that almost goes without saying, but that an opera obsessed in the best ways, general director, would, if forced to pick one composer, the man who never wrote what would normally be considered an opera, but whose worldview, well, he basically invented the word worldview for music.
He did.
Is operatic.
And I think it's that sense of worldview that I respond so strongly to. I think there is no limit to his horizons. And I feel when I listen to his music, there is no limit to my horizons. Mm-hmm. I think the sense of revelation that his music conveys is endless and is endlessly rewarding. I think one of the greatest human characteristics is curiosity. I think as a human race, we would be much the poorer if we weren't curious.
There's a marvelous quote misattributed to Dorothy Parker. I have not yet found, after years of search, who actually said it. The only cure for boredom is curiosity. There is no cure for curiosity. And as Studs Terkel also said, he wanted his epitaph to be, "Curiosity did not kill this cat." So now you're bringing us something now to wrap up our second hour, and we could do 10 of these hours. I mean, this has been such a pleasure for me, and I hope for the listeners, well, I'm sure it has been, with Antony Freud, general director of the Lyric Opera of Chicago. You're wrapping this up with something that will be a curiosity for many people, both in terms of the song and the singer. And there's a story behind it, both the song and why it's important to you.
I have a Scottish husband, Colin Ure, and we've
spell the last name.
U-R-E, and please note it's pronounced Ure. We've been a couple for more than 30 years, and so I feel more than half Scottish. When I met him, Colin was a singer, long since stopped singing professionally, but sings at home quite a lot.
And he has a musical voice when he speaks. At least if you're not from Scotland, you hear it.
Well, as WFMT audiences get the chance to hear when he hosts the Ryan Opera Centre recital series on 98.7 WFMT. He's a dramaturg now. He writes, he translates supertitles, he gives lectures, and he's happily involved with WFMT. But he's proudly and passionately Scottish. His family is Chuchta, which means that it's from the Highlands. His mother's family was from the Western Isles. And there's a hugely engaging, tuneful, moving tradition of folk song in Scotland. And Colin sings at home a lot. And more often than not, when he sings, he's singing Scots songs. His mother, who I had the pleasure of knowing very well for many years, she stayed with us many times in Houston, sadly died before we moved to Chicago, so she never discovered our life here, was very Tjukta, which means that her mentality, her approach to life was totally influenced by her roots in the Hebrides.
Would English and American cinemas have given her subtitles when she was speaking, as they do with Scott's films?
I think so. Okay. We had a house in Houston with a balcony, and when she visited us there, having spent most of her life in cold, wet Glasgow, she loved the Houston heat. So she sat outside, and anyone who passed in the street, she chatted to. I don't think she understood a word that anyone said, nor did anyone understand a word she said. But she was a great spirit, great human being.
And the spirit was clearly there in those exchanges.
Absolutely. And Colin, I have to say, has inherited that spirit. So this is a song called Road to the Isles. It was written in 1917. It has an interesting history. Marjorie Kennedy Fraser was a really pioneering woman who went on extended trips around the Hebrides exploring traditional folk music. The tune is thought to be one of the tunes that she discovered on these travels. The words are written by Kenneth MacLeod, a Scottish poet. And it was originally dedicated to the Scottish regiments that were fighting on the Western Front in World War I. It's a wonderfully romantic song. It's about the irrepressible draw of the Western Isles. I will try and tell you some of the words. My Scots isn't very good, but I'll do my best. A far croonin' is pulling me away. As take I were my cromac to the road. The far coolans, the coolans are the hills of the Isle of Skye, the far coolans are putting love on me, as step I with the sunlight for my load.
Ah, far croonan is pulling me away, as take I wi my cromac to the road. The far coolins are putting love on me, a step I wi the sunlight for my load. Sure by Tummel and Loch Rannoch and Loch Aber I will go, by heather tracks wi heaven in their wilds. If it's thinking in your inner heart of braggarts in my step, you've never smelt the tangle o' the aisles. The far coolins are putting love on me, as step I wi my cromach to the isles. 'Tis by Sheil water the track is to the west, by Eilert and by Morar to the sea. The cool caresses I am thinking o' for pluck, and bracken for a wink on mother knee. Sure by Tummel and Loch Rannoch and Loch Aber I will go, by heather tracks wi heaven in their wilds. If it's thinking in your inner head, braggarts in my step, you've never smelt the tangle o' the aisles. Oh, the far coolins are putting love on me, as step away my cromach to the isles. Oh, the blue islands are pulling me away, their laughter puts the leap upon the lame. The blue islands from the Skerries to the Lows, wi heather honey taste upon each name. Sure by Tummel and Loch Rannoch and Loch Aber I will go, by heather tracks wi heaven in their wilds. If it's thinking in your inner heart, braggarts in my step, you've never smelt the tangle o' the aisles. Oh, the far coolins are putting love on me, as step I wi my cromach to the aisles.
You've never smelt the tangle of the aisles where laughter puts the leap upon the lame.
Isn't that a great sentiment? Laughter together, putting yes. the leap upon the lame.
Absolutely.
What more could one want?
Nothing. Andy Stewart with an EW in Stewart, 1933 to 1993, one of the popular performers of the Scottish popular repertoire. I've never been to the Hebrides or Orkneys, but I've been to Skye, and I was there before the bridge, so it really was the Isle of Skye, and I feel the mist, and I feel that connection. And wonderful, isn't it, to find another person who not only shares your general interests and makes a great life companion, but where you can share music. I know some couples where, oh, she's the music one or he's the music one or something. And I think I couldn't live if I didn't live with somebody who loved music.
That's right. And laughter.
And laughter, which is the key to why you and Colin are together for 30 plus years, is laughter. Anthony Freud brings us very serious things and very funny things and very warm things and very difficult and thoughtful things because he brings us opera, and opera brings us the world. Because Gustav Mahler told them to. He was one of the great opera conductors of all time, but he wrote in a different way. And Anthony clearly has shown us here that it's not so much the form or the formula, it's the quality and the depth and the richness and the warmth that connects with him in music. And thank you so much, Anthony Freud, for sharing with us. We are speaking on the eve of the 2014-2015 Lyric Opera season, and many riches that we'll be talking about throughout the season. We've wanted to have this conversation and hear some of this music with Anthony for some time. We're so happy that it worked out today. Thank you so much for coming in, Anthony.
Andrew, I've had a lovely time. Thank you very much for having us, me.
And public thanks to Anthony Freud for sharing these hours with us this week and last week as well. Thanks to Anthony's executive assistant, Sam Albright, for helping us to arrange the fulfillment of this long-awaited interview. Matt DiStefano put the program together with me and made it sound great. Our funders, Alphawood Foundation, and other friends of this program, WFMT.com/Critical Thinking is where you can find the always free Critical Thinking podcast. Rentap, that's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com, is where you can find me. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.